This is Fresh Air. In the last 15 years, millions of TV viewers have defected from the three major networks. Up until the mid-70s, the networks could claim 9 out of 10 viewers. But with the choices offered by cable, Fox, and the video store, all that has changed. The networks have also lost advertisers and profits. The decline of the network empires is the subject of the new book Three Blind Mice by journalist Ken Auletta. His other books include The Underclass and Greed and Glory on Wall Street. I asked Auletta if he thinks the networks are dying or just becoming different.
They're certainly becoming different. They are cutting back not only their expenses, but what they do. I think you will have in a few years' time, some of the networks at least, will probably be out of the sports business. One or two may be out of the news business. They're certainly out of the news business the way they once were in the news business. That is to say, they no longer pretend to be a worldwide news-gathering organization. They no longer pretend to do serious or very many serious documentaries. The documentaries they now do tend to be salacious. They are continuing to cut back in recent years the amount of programming that they do. So I think instead of, say, 22 hours a week of primetime programming, they will probably produce less than that in order to save money. So they are certainly very different today than they were 10 years ago when they enjoyed a monopoly.
You've been working on this book since the mid-1980s. And in the time that, I think it was during the time you were researching this book, all three networks were sold and bought. And so ABC is now owned by Cap Cities, NBC by GE, CBS by Lowe's Corporation. Give us the big picture first. What does it mean that each of the networks was sold in the mid-80s?
Well, what it means is that, first of all, they were sold because government allowed them to be sold. Government no longer stood up and protected a network from being bought by someone else, as they did say when ITT tried to buy ABC in 1968, and they said no. But they were allowed to be sold, as a lot of things are being sold in America. And what it means is that in place of the entrepreneurs who had created the networks, the Leonard Goldensons, the William Paley's, David Sarnoff's, what you had are people who basically were businessmen who didn't have much acquaintance with Hollywood and with the product. They were basically people who had a lot of acquaintance with costs. And so the center of gravity shifted from putting on programming at the networks to controlling costs. And the question, among the questions that might be asked, is there a public trust associated with owning a network? And if there is, what happens when that public responsibility clashes with your costs? And in the old days, there was a greater tendency, in part because government kept the pressure on the networks, in part because the new owners grew up in this tradition of saying we have a public obligation to do things to serve the public interest. And that sense of obligation has been lessened.
The networks are each bought by companies that do a lot of other stuff in the entertainment and broadcasting world. Where do they see the networks fitting in to the bigger picture of these companies?
Well, particularly at NBC, which is owned by General Electric, which is a global superpower. That's how they think of themselves at General Electric. And at Cap Cities, ABC, which is into publications, both magazines and newspapers, and cable programming and owning investment, major investor in the Broadway theater, TV stations, and a network. All of these two companies in particular, see themselves as potential global superpowers, communication superpowers, who basically will control their product and how it is distributed from the idea, let's say, that it first appears in a book that they published, to whether that book is sold to a TV, for a TV show or to the movies, to whether it is distributed at their movie theaters or on their network, to whether it is sold to local stations by their syndication arm, by whether it is sold worldwide to other TV stations owned by themselves or movie companies owned by themselves. So what they want to be basically is what people want to be in all businesses if they're giant companies. They want to be vertically integrated. They want to control everything from the creation of the idea to the manufacture of that idea to the distribution of that idea.
What sounds really bad about that is that it really decreases editorial freedom and kind of decreases potentially the free exchange of ideas, in the sense that the ideas get purchased because it's part of the company. You know what I mean? It gets made into the movie because of the company investing in it earlier along the line,
as opposed to because the
director really wants to make it or whatever, the editor at the publishing house really wants to see it become a book.
That is the menace. The menace is that you replace many voices with few, and that you'll have a situation, as the chairman of Sony stood up some months ago, and he said, I couldn't imagine Sony allowing our studio, Columbia, to do a picture about that, meaning anti-Japanese feeling in America, was the question posed to him. Well, that is exactly what you don't want a creative company to do, to be managed from the top down. You want ideas, as you're suggesting, to percolate from the producer, the writer, whatever. And the danger is less that the chairman of Sony or the chairman of General Electric or the chairman of Cap Cities will reach down and say, don't do this, though that might happen. The real danger that I would worry about, and what I try to report in my book on, is anticipatory censorship. That is to say, someone who works at NBC decides that, my God, our boss may be upset at us, so we better not stick our neck out. And that's what I mean by anticipatory censorship, censorship from the bottom up.
And you think that this could work for other things as well, since the parent company is into so many aspects of business.
There are so
many ways you can potentially alienate the people at the top.
Absolutely. I mean, Today's Show did not run a piece initially in 1989 on a GE nuclear power plant, done for the Today Show out of the Midwest by a reporter out there. When it got out in the press, and the press reported this, the executive producer then of Today's Show, Marty Ryan, said, well, the report wasn't finished. Now, if you believe that, I have a bridge I'd like to sell you. But the truth is, they were so embarrassed by the report that they had to air the report on the Today Show several weeks later. But the danger is that if that story had not gotten out, that piece would not have been reported on a GE division, because GE owns NBC.
Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more about some of the things that you found in your investigation of the networks. My guest is journalist Ken Auletta, and is the author of the new book, Three Blind Mice, How the TV Networks Lost Their Way. This is Fresh Air. Ken Auletta is my guest, and his new book, Three Blind Mice, is about a new era for the TV networks, an era where they no longer have a monopoly over TV. You said earlier in the interview that the TV networks are no longer pretending to be worldwide news gathering services, and I'm not sure I can agree with that. I mean, when I do get to watch the evening news, I don't see anybody making apologies about their coverage of the Soviet Union or the Middle East or whatever. It's not like they've stopped trying to do that. So what exactly do you mean?
They are firemen. What they do is if a fire breaks out in the Soviet Union, they rush troops to cover it. If a fire breaks out in the Gulf War, they rush troops to cover it. But essentially, they have curbed and cut back the number of overseas bureaus. You do not find any of the three networks, I'm excluding CNN, having a bureau in Africa. None in South America. In Europe, they have contracted. In the Middle East, they have contracted. So what you have is at the three networks, because they are consumed with questions of costs and with potential losses in their news division, and under pressure from the new owners, they have cut back and curbed their activities. That doesn't mean they don't cover, and cover sometimes splendidly, a crisis in the Soviet Union as they're doing now. But they are not there all the time, working the phones, building up sources, becoming familiar with the local culture and local politics.
What were the effects of the Gulf War on the networks? You know, initially you might have thought would have been good for network news, because people were really just glued to their television set, desperate for as much information as they could possibly get. But really, it didn't have such a good effect on network news. What was the problem?
Well, I think the implicit problem, which is the bigger problem for the networks, is that one of the lessons that grew out of the Gulf War was that the viewer was forced to confront a new truth, which is that, in fact, CNN was there all the time. You didn't have to wait to make an appointment at 6:30 or 7 at night with the network to find out what happened in the day's world. You could find out any time of the day, 24 hours a day, by tuning to CNN, but not just CNN. You can tune to all news radio. But this was just the Gulf War was a vivid reminder, in fact, that you can get your news anywhere. And in fact, that's just what happened. The network, after being on the air almost continuously the first few days of the war, dropped out and resorted to the regular scheduled newscast, leaving the field to CNN, and CNN thrived.
What are some of the big questions for the future of network TV now?
I'll tell you one of the big ones that has received too little notice, and I think it's one actually that strengthens the argument of the three networks. What you do when you replace three powerful networks which provided Americans with a common experience, a common church. 79% of Americans watched Roots. You know, 90-some-odd percent were watching I Love Lucy. When you replace that common experience with 150 different channels, it makes it much harder for people to have a common experience, which leads to the future question, which is this. What do you do when the networks say they can no longer afford to run, to say, the conventions, the political conventions, which is happening next year, by the way. We're going to see that. But more important, what happens when the networks say, look, we cannot afford to pay for the Super Bowl or the World Series? And the cable fellas will pay for it because they've got a lot more money than we do, and they've got a couple of different sources of revenue which we don't have. So they will pay for it. But then the public comes back and they say, hey, wait a second. Cable is in only 60% of all American homes. You mean to tell me that this is a have versus have-not issue? That the only people who can watch the Super Bowl or the World Series are those who can afford to pay a monthly subscription cost to cable? That's a real... So free television, the issue of free television, and whether we are going to get to a point very soon where so-called free television will no longer be providing the American viewer with things like the World Series, like the Super Bowl, perhaps some news, perhaps the conventions, perhaps a presidential debate, that they thought came with the franchise of free television. Well, and that, I think, really poses some very profound questions for America.
Are you making the argument in favor of legislation of some sort or another?
I am making the argument that government has a larger role to play than they have played in regulating what is a scarce public resource. The airwaves.
Would you expect the government to say, well, the Super Bowl is too important to have it be on PATV?
I expect them to at least face the question.
Well, Ken Auletta, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry.
Ken Auletta is the author of Three Blind Mice, How the TV Networks Lost Their Way. This is Fresh Air.